The Lord be with you. A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Luke. The shepherds went with haste to Bethlehem and found Mary and Joseph and the child lying in the manger. When they saw this, they made known what had been told to them about this child, and all who heard it were amazed at what the shepherds told them. But Mary treasured all these words and pondered them in her heart. The shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all that they had heard and seen, as it had been told to them. After 8 days had passed, it was time to circumcise the child, and he was called Jesus, the name given by the angel before he was conceived in the womb. The Gospel of the Lord. So I don't know if you've seen it in this. Sometimes the news is actually helpful. I find it generally not, because it doesn't often give you the patient reflection that is actually required to know what's happening in the world. Very often it's explosion here, movement here, da-da-da-da-da. But there was one story that seemed to be slightly indicative of the culture, and it was, I don't know if you heard of it, this called the affluenza case. There was this little dude, kid, beyond reckoning, kills 4 people in a car accident. And there are many things involved. He kills 4 people in a car accident. And then in the trial, the defense was, well, you know, he was so spoiled and had so much in his life, he doesn't know right from wrong. And they gave him probation. And everyone was like, so this is one of those things that on the news you're like, oh no, the whole thing is now crumbling down. Because this kid goes off and gets off on probation. His mom gets in a little bit more trouble, but this was the really funny part. At Christmas time, my grandfather brings up the story and says, oh, by the way, they fled to Mexico. What? So not only does this kid get so spoiled rotten that he doesn't take moral responsibility for killing 4 people, but then his mother further enables him and sends him to live in a... And when they finally bust this kid, it was so... Like, it was tragically funny. One of those funny moments where you laugh, but it's not like, ha, 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 laugh, but it's like, ha, 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 laugh. That kind... That the other kind of laugh. And you saw the picture of this kid, and he's like, ugh. Like... And you get a glimpse into this narcissism. And the really weird and tragic thing about a kid like that, the spoiled, rotten kid, we've all met them, is they're always a victim. I have met thousands of them in my lifetime. The kid that has everything, we call them first world problems. You know, they have everything. They've been blessed with so much, and then they stub their toe, and then it's a massive conspiracy against them. That any attempt whatsoever to befriend them, to be kind to them, whatever, is just, oh, you just don't understand me. And for the rest of us on the outside, there's this painful, tragic feeling of, on one level, you'd like to just shake them silly. But on another level, it's just that powerlessness. Just nothing you can do for a guy like this. Nothing. He's reached that point where that's it. And why does it get so bad? Like, how did a mother allow her son to turn into such a little punk? Well, the hard part is that it's really hard for a mother who loves her kid in the transcendental way in which a parent has to love their kid because they're theirs, to tell them that they are a punk. Any parent knows exactly how hard this is to balance truth and mercy. And so very often we say we're loving people, but then when it becomes devoid of truth, then you can tell when this love is completely distorted, when it has no reference whatsoever to reality. And the really tragic thing is that this is how so many, this is how you can have a mother, you know, going to a dinner party and saying, well, my kid is really special and important and a good child and blah, 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 blah. And then if you actually look really closely just down the hall, that kid is torturing the other kids. Any one of you who works in a school knows exactly how this works. They know how to play the system. They know how to play their parents. They know how to play the world so that everybody thinks them to be good people. But the thing is that that perception becomes a prison. The perception of beauty becomes a prison because they know they're loved for superficial reasons, which is often why spoiled kids are ridiculously superficial. When they look and they see a celebrity and they think, I want to be like that, and you can look at them and go, why would you want to be like that person? They're like, well, they're rich and happy. On what terms? Now, one of the really interesting things that can happen is that also if you have a magnificently talented child, that is one of the most difficult jobs in being a parent. Because if you've got a really smart, clever, beautiful child, you know, like, I don't know about you dads out there, but I'm pretty sure that some of you are like, oh man, I've got a beautiful daughter. What am I going to do when she turns 15? This is terrifying. This is scaring me because I'm a man. I know what I wanted when I was 15. You have this moment when the goods and the blessings pile up, the scarier it gets because the nature and the subtlety of effective parenting and guidance becomes more and more complicated. And then he got married. She has the only begotten son. And it's an interesting, weird, and reflection thing because Mary, even though she has every right to be able to say, well, not my child. This is why you need to have the sinless, well, not what the only reason, and it's not a need thing. It's an important distinction to say that God doesn't need anything from us. But God chooses to help her, to give her the grace so that she may freely choose to be sinless. That's a really complicated statement that takes a bit of clarity here. But only she would have the eternally begotten son and then not brag to the neighbors about it. She's like, guess how my son was conceived? Yes, Mary, we've heard it 1,000 times before. The angel came to you. You're a grand visionary, blah, 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 blah. And you can tell this by, in the Nazareth narratives, everyone thinks that Mary is a nobody. She has so many special things happen to her, and she is not even remotely interested in them. What she's interested in is pondering this mystery in her heart. And then, even when there are moments when she knows that deep down she's not obligated to follow the law with her son, she still does it. She has him circumcised on the 8th day. She brings him, and that's actually what today used to be called as well, the circumcision of the Lord. We just kind of sanitized it a little bit, called Mary the Mother of God, and attached it to a feast, which I will explain in a few minutes. You have this moment where she constantly says, I don't have to, but I will. That is something that every parent that has to grow and to help their children be the best people that they can be have to teach. It's moving beyond the mere obligation into something transcendentally beautiful. Today is a holy day of obligation. You must go to Mass. But my hope is, my sincerest desire is, that today being a day when she becomes open and a possibility to you, because you don't have to work, hopefully, unless you're the service industry, otherwise you're exhausted and tired, but you choose to be present at the altar of God, because you know your life is given to you here. Not because of the beauty of the building, it may be beautiful. Not because the beauty of the priest, because he ain't. Not because necessarily the community rubs you the right way or the wrong way, but because this is the fellowship of God gathered together, not by merit, but by grace. Because if there is one thing that we as Christians must never become, is the most terrifying thing in the world, kids with spiritual affluenza. Catholics, I am sorry to say, are easily the worst for this. In terms of having this sense of grace-filled entitlement that now that I've been baptized, now that I've received grace, I can do, say whatever I want because I'll be forgiven. I can do, say whatever I want because I feel God inside me. Because I can say or do whatever I want to my children or my workplace or whatever, because I know the secret mystical truth that God is beyond all morality. And the very simple biblical example that we are given today, and in the nature of this feast, is something far more profound. That the eternally begotten Son of God chooses to become flesh, and as Paul says, subjects himself to the law, and Mary, that has the special chosen child that is only from God, also submits herself to the law so that it may bring it to fulfillment. To see the immediate moment of reversal of all of our human expectations, where we would think, if I were God, I would have it my way. And in Jesus now it is revealed, now that God is God, he wants to give us his way, to give himself a way for us. Now, the reason why this feast of Mary, the Mother of God, is important, and for some ways for Catholics, it's intuitive. We would just go, yeah, well, Jesus is the Son of God, so obviously Mary's the Mother of God. It's a pretty simple reasoning process. And in fact, the Christian church had been celebrating a feast of this manner for several centuries. But it wasn't until the Council of Ephesus in 431, 431 years AD, where the bishops of the Mediterranean and Eastern and bits of Asia all got together, not as big as Vatican II, but a good number of them, and they got together to discuss the issue about whether or not Mary's the Mother of God. It was built on what happened in Council of Nicaea in 325 and the Council of Constantinople I, because there were several Constantinoples, in 381, where it was finally and definitively proclaimed that Jesus is equal to the Father. The way it's given in our Nicene Constantinople Creed in the Mass, consubstantial with the Father. And this was not just some theological word game where they were, like, according to Dan Brown, who just doesn't know his history, you have this feeling that, oh, well, it was just some dogma that was invented to give control to people. No. The control was exerted by the heretics. The Arians that wanted to deny the fact that Jesus is equal to the Father in a... It's a really subtle theology, and I'm not going to waste your time with it. But you have this feeling that they said, well, we want to have a state religion that is complete and yet non-offensive. That somehow God won't ruin the established order. And so the heresy was actually advocated by all the powerful people and even the emperor himself eventually. So after Nicaea, Athanasius is able to defend the Nicene faith that Jesus is equal to the Father. And then the heretic said, well, we lost. What's the best thing we can do? We'll go through the halls of power, make slightly unlettered emperors go on our side, and we will force the Orthodox into exile. That goes on for decades. And by some ridiculous miracle, the church's proclamation shone through. And Athanasius's point was very clear, that the whole point of the resurrection, the whole point of the incarnation, the whole reason that the Word became flesh on Christmas and died for us on Good Friday and rose again on Easter Sunday was that God would become man so that men and women can become like God. No mere mortal can accomplish this grand miracle. For when your atheist and non-religious friend comes up to you and says, well, how can you claim to have exclusive knowledge of God? Your answer is, I don't. And I can't think my way to God. God has descended to us. And not on our terms, but on his. But the point of Mary, the Mother of God, is to say that in God's descent, Mary is a participator. That in her free acceptance of Christ in her life, by her faith, she can, in the Augustine's example is, She, by her faith, she conceived the word. It was offered, and she accepted. That she is a co-author of the humanity of God. And Nestorius, a nice, clean philosopher, I wouldn't say he was a heretic in the same way that Arius was a heretic, but he said, that can't be so. It can't be so that Mary would participate in such a way. How could she possibly be the mother of God, that she could be like a conduit of God or something, but she can't truly bear him. She can't truly be his mother. And Cyril of Alexandria, who's a bishop of a place in northern Africa in Egypt, he says, no, it must be so. Because if there is no human participation in the divine mystery, this whole Christian enterprise is a giant waste of time. For there are two extremes of Catholic Christian life that must always be avoided. Excessive humanism, this feeling that we can do it on our own, this feeling that we don't need God to transform our hearts, that we can build the city of God. And there is the opposite one that says, well, you know, if we just pray hard enough, God will fix our problems. We don't actually have to truly engage the mind. We don't have to engage the will. We don't have to engage the body. We don't have to engage ourselves in civil and social life. We can just, you know, have our small little place where we compartmentalize God. We make him make us feel good for a little bit of time, and then we go off and sin just as much as we like. And the real tragic thing is, it's that inhuman spirituality that has turned off generations of Catholics from the church. They remember that bishop, they remember that priest, they remember that mother, they remember that grandmother, grandfather, friend, whatever, that did that, that justified their religious and social crimes and used their religion as a way of protecting themselves from their conscience. We mustn't do that. It must be repented of. In this feast of Mary, the Mother of God, we must truly recapture the mystery that to be truly a Christian means to be truly human, that there is no good thing in the human condition that we can separate from our Catholic life. Art, music, beauty, culture, social expression, intellectual vibrancy, science, the arts, everything is an expression of our Catholic life. And this challenge must always stand before us. Because in Mary's life, she doesn't have to know the details. She just needs to make the choice. And for the centuries to come, we will have, yes, many more difficulties, and we will grow through so many pains and struggles. But if we truly do not want to be that spiritual affluenza kid, because we've been given so much by such a loving mother and by such a gracious father, the most important thing for us to do is to ponder their words in our heart. And not just to keep them there, but to give them out. Because the way in which Mary truly echoes the mission of her son, and you can hear it in the two sentences that both of them are most famous for, take, eat, this is my body given for you. Behold, the handmaid of the Lord, be it done unto me according to your word.